Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Rob?
Today, Russell, I am feeling feverish.
Ooh.
And I've chosen that word because today we are meeting two guests, not one. Mm. And when they unite and collaborate and come together, there's often this incredible whirl of frenetic energy and creativity and actually groundbreaking artwork that is created. And our two guests are both artists. One is best known for songwriting and music and singing and that kind of side of creativity, and the other is best known for writing but predominantly painting. And when they come together, they, for the past 30 years, they've created this kind of what I almost see like as a kind of time capsule, that if you look back on it, you're going to be able to see like the politics of our time, what it felt like to be alive, you know, at the turn of the century into the 2000s. Yeah, it's really meaningful. That might sound a bit sort of grand, but it's actually true, because the work they've created together for the whole Radiohead project, which has been now 30 years, 30 million albums sold, like it's been this kind of global sensation, but it's actually deeply artistic project, which is why we would like to welcome them on Talk Art.
Woo!
So today we're here at the Standard London, and we would like to welcome
Tom York and Stanley Domworth.
Hello. It's like a game show.
I thought you were talking about someone else.
How you guys doing?
All right.
Yeah, yeah.
Where have you come from today? You live in Oxfordshire, right?
Uh-huh. I've been stuck on the West Way, so I'm like winding down after that.
Yes, of course. Traffic. And you, Stanley, you're in Brighton.
On the coast, yes.
How was your trip in?
It was just, you know, a train. But I haven't been for a swim this morning, so...
Tough gig.
You know, I had to get up a bit early, you know?
Do you swim a lot? I live in Margate, so I swim in the sea most days.
Yeah, I like it, yeah. It's getting a bit cold.
Yeah.
You got
a wetsuit?
No.
Oxford is the furthest place from the sea in the whole country, apparently.
Is it?
Yeah.
So you definitely don't go swimming in the sea?
He did. He went swimming on Christmas Eve.
Yeah, I did, actually.
In a river.
In a river
in Oxford?
Yeah.
How was that?
That was a bit rough. Couldn't feel my feet for like an hour and a half afterwards. I ran back. Anyway, it's a long story.
So when was the last time you two saw each other?
The other day.
Yes, we sing each other far too much.
Yes.
But you're Bezzers, right? You're best mates and you have been since art school.
It's a purely professional relationship. Can't stand the guy myself.
Technically speaking, we have known each other for a while, yes.
And we are here today because you currently have an exhibition at Christie's in London of paintings of artwork from the Radiohead albums over the past 30 years. And you two have been collaborating for the whole time, pretty much since the Bends, I think. Is that correct? And also you have a new book coming out, and well, two books coming out, actually. And then also a digital exhibition. You have like a whole array of artistic endeavours which are happening over the next month and a
half. There's too many prongs for one fork. Yeah. It's ridiculous.
But if we start with the exhibition in London, can you talk a bit about how that came to fruition?
It's based around the Kid A and Amnesiac era, because, well, I'll try and do this in one paragraph. Basically, we got approached by the V&A to do something, and we sort of didn't really want to do a retrospective because it was a bit meh. And I'd always had a small obsession about the way we had to close up the Kid A Amnesiac period, and how a lot of what happened a lot of the madness of finally having our own studio and our own workplace and our own painting studio and all this stuff, we generated in a frenzy all this material, and it kind of got lost or it got used, but not really.
Everything was reduced down to a compact disc and a 12 centimeter square jewel case.
Yeah.
Which is disappointing.
Yeah.
Yes.
So we talked to the V&A about that, and then we realised, and what we wanted to do is use the audio with it, and we wanted to do it like a sort of like an installation, and then that didn't work. So, and in the process of scratching our heads, trying to figure out what to do with this material, we're also going through the material and kind of shocked about where we were at around that time as well.
Yes, I don't recognise that lunatic.
Yeah, me.
And I don't recognise myself either in that period.
No, notebooks especially. Well, actually, everything, the sketches. Yeah. Anyway.
Because you've hung on to everything, you've archived everything, you have multiple notebooks.
Archive is a grand word for...
Yeah, for not knowing where the hell anything is.
Yeah.
All right. It's all there, though. I mean, it might not be alphabetized, but
it just
it's all
wasn't
there.
Thrown away.
We had to get it sort of put into shape by a friend of ours, Christine, because we couldn't. Anyway, then we moved on. We couldn't do it in the V&A because what we were thinking in our heads, they didn't have a space available. Then we wanted to build a space. Then we couldn't do that. Then we went to the Albert Hall. We wanted to build a space there. We got shut down.
It was going to be great.
It was going to be brilliant. Oh, wow. We were going to build a big tower of red blocks.
Out of shipping containers.
Out of shipping containers. And then it all went basically tits up when English Heritage heard about it.
I thought it was Westminster Council.
Oh, it's all the same.
They said it was like a giant advert for Radiohead.
Yeah,
to which it was like, what do you think? The Albert Hall is a giant monument to the royal family.
Anyway, and then just at the point of despondency when we sort of gave up, lockdown occurred and everything sort of went into 3D space anyway. Friends of mine in the fashion industry were going 3D, and the way we were designing the space, we were using 3D programs anyway with our friend Sean in New York, and we just sort of thought, well, shit, we'll just do it virtually. And then it became something super exciting. Which you will see.
Reality was removed.
Yeah, we thought, well, there's no point in making it into a real boring art gallery. We'll do something else. So we have been doing, and you'll see that in a bit.
Mm.
But that's exciting. What's come out of the pandemic is that culture didn't stand still. It adapted. Now, what you've done, what you're creating now, what you're going on to now, probably would never have existed if we hadn't gone through what we've all just been through the last 18 months.
Yeah, I think we both agree that right now it's quite painful to watch everything go back so fast.
Yeah.
Because I think we learned a lot.
Yeah.
And now we're trying to forget it, unlearn it.
Yeah. Go back to normality, yeah. Or what was normality?
Yeah. I mean, it's just little things like shaking hands. That's a weird thing to do, isn't it? Yeah. When you haven't done it for ages, you think, why do we do that? Why that? And not anything else.
Why is that what humans do?
Yeah. Well, humans in this culture, anyway.
Yes.
It was definitely something that it kind of grew far beyond the parameters it would have had if it had existed as a real physical space.
But the fun thing about it was like all informed by the work. So we said, like, no new work, no new work, no new work. But these spaces evolved out of the combination of the music and artwork and, you know.
It was all there already. The weird
thing. You just had to pick up a piece of paper and, like, why don't we try that?
Yeah, it's almost, as time went on and this sort of developed, it was as if we'd made all this material 20 years too early, because it just was, that was what it was for.
Yeah.
In a way,
to be created into an actual space. This is going to sound daft until you see it.
Because this is actually a digital space as well, isn't it?
Yeah,
and it's going to come out in November at some point, and there'll be lots more details revealed, which we can't reveal yet. But but it's going to essentially be on Mac and PC and through Sony PlayStation. Is that right?
Yeah,
yeah.
Well, because that's the only way that this software works. you know, so that's where we went.
But it's everything. It's all of your lyrics and drawings and work.
Yeah. It's everything, but not in a way that, like, in no way would you call it a library. In no way would you be able to sort of stand there and reference, oh, I'll just go and look at this. But, you know, I mean, there is, yeah, I'm not resisting the temptation to explain the rooms to you, because if I do that, then I'm giving it away.
Well, your manager earlier showed me a quick sort of 2-minute video, and it looks like super immersive, kind of like I've always seen the whole Radiohead project in a way, including Stanley Donwood's artwork on the sleeves, as being this giant artwork, a bit like some kind of Gesamtkunst. Werk or something like that, big word, which kind of means including all different elements of creativity, not just one art form.
Yeah.
And that's what I think, looking back, it's so clear that that's what it is, from the words, you know, that you sing, to the sounds. Like, I remember when, if you think on the albums you're talking about, like Everything in Its Right Place, I remember listening to that on loop when I was about 20 years old and almost feeling like I was levitating, because that itself becomes visual, like the audio became visual for me. And it kind of, surrounds you in a way that other music doesn't. Right. And was that something that you guys have always been sort of aware of in your collaboration together, to try and use visual art to take the music somewhere else?
To elevate it.
I guess. I mean, the first thing we did was, you know, before we'd done anything, any artwork ever, was go into the big HMV or whatever it was in Oxford High Street and just look, because at that time it was mostly vinyl. And so there was just a wall of 12-inch squares of artwork. It was, you know, the most democratic art gallery conceivable, because all of the art is equal. Its prominence is due to how many units the record is wrapped round.
Or how it's alphabetized.
Yeah. So it was just like we looked at this big wall of pictures and right, okay, we've got to beat them. And so it's like that was the first thing. It's like, you know, get people to pick it up.
Right.
But, you know, I think it's a kind of almost like an art school sensibility to treat project.
We did drive
a whole.
We did drive when we were at art school. We did drive one particular guy who I don't know what we were supposed to be doing, but it ended up being these heated debates about where art should be shown in the late 1980s, early 90s, and whether, you know, the idea of a gallery space was a bit like, well, who's benefiting from the gallery space? Yeah. And, you know, the democratization of art in the commercial sense. And we were always banging on about how art should be on the high street. I should be available for everybody. Art's on the buses going past here, unfortunately.
Yes.
It's flogging shit you don't want. But there's this big, big area. Anyway, back to your question. Your question was about the sort of link between the visual and the music side of it. For me, that's always been a necessary part of what happens with the sound and music for me, is that sense that there's a visual element to it in this, and I don't mean visual as in illustrative of a visual. I mean the sort of sounds that we tend to pick, and the sort of the approach that we had in the recording studio is one of, like, I'm looking for that kind of stimulation. Like when Everything is Right Place, for example, went through a whole series of smashing your head against walls, going nowhere, until plugging in an old Prophet synthesizer and this sound coming out of it, and after months and months, and going, that's it, you know. And within a couple of hours, the basic sort of track was done. We tried loads of stuff on top, but we went back to this core thing because it was so strong. It had such a key, like, colour to it. I mean, I was seeing it as like this frosty red colour. And it's to me more similar to painting than it is to composing or recording or like, oh, go and, if you just go and sit in the booth over there and play your acoustic guitar And we'll, you know, put some stuff on top. Thanks very much. It was like that particular song. It's like I didn't have the words until I had that sound on the synthesizer, for example. I only had like a few phrases. And so it's that thing, like, so when I watch, when I was watching Dan, Mr. Donald over here, exploring painting again, when we finally got our own space, that the similarities between, like, you just throw some stuff on the canvas and you wipe out what doesn't work and you keep going and you keep going and you keep going until you find a colour or you find a tone and you find a key and then you form stuff around that key. They're just the same to me. Mm. It's the same method.
Because it's very immersive. And what when we were working in this studio, so everyone is in the same space.
Yeah.
And so when, you know, exactly as Tom was saying, is they're kind of just sort of putting stuff up, wiping it away, putting more stuff up, wiping it away, and there's traces of it always, all the time. You can see what was there before because it's a very organic process.
But that's the music side of it, because the art side of it, you had a self-imposed rule that you would never erase. You can't undo.
Oh, no, that was OK Computer.
That was OK Computer. Yeah. So before that, you
that
were...
Was because that was purely digital. And there was a new thing called like Apple Z or Undo or whatever, so you could literally undo what you just did, which was kind of a big cheat. So that was a self-imposed rule. With Kid A, it was a different matter. That was because we'd done all that digitally with we didn't know it was going to be called Kid A till the very last moment. But
I'd love to know about that story then of how you were both struggling and then you sort of stuck everything up on the kitchen fridge and had a mad moment.
Oh, yeah. I found all those. I found all the bits of paper.
All the dodgy titles.
With the dodgy titles and the bad fonts and everything. Yeah, no. I saw it. I put them in a safe place.
Yeah, thank you.
Well,
what happened? So you were both struggling to find the cover art and the title.
Everything.
Everything.
Yeah, deadlines do these things to you. You know, you got to sweat. I mean, we were up till like 4 a.m. one night. And a mad panic.
Because we had to finish it, you know.
Finally, after what, a year and a half self-indulgent madness.
And they gave you a date. They said, this is the date it needs to be ready by. You were getting that put on you, that pressure.
It was self-imposed, but we didn't want to let anybody down, I think.
It was just kind of, I don't know, I think we were going mad.
Mm.
But yeah, so we kind of just we just stuck everything onto the sellotaped everything to the fridges and the
and these are sketches
and stuff
that you painted.
They were like printed out
right
possible covers for this record. What we have been doing for the last 2 years.
Yeah, because we'd gone in so many different directions. Mm. You could just blink and spin around and just choose one, and it would mean something completely different. Mm. It was what we hadn't. What we've never done, in fact, I don't think, maybe the eraser, but I don't really think so. What we've never really done is started with a cover. It just doesn't happen. Anyway, there we were.
The eraser was the last thing that I carved out of lino as well. And that was supposed to be a kind of nuclear power no thanks idea to start with.
That's right, yeah.
It's completely different.
You start one place and you end up always somewhere completely different.
Yeah.
And Kid A, the title Kid A was just a file name of some MIDI file that I had. And I don't know why it was called that. This is what we're talking about. It illustrates the sort of like, I think really the act of creating, the act of generating material and accepting the fact that you don't understand that material at the time.
Yeah.
So you generate a volume of work, and then you have to exactly like with working on the music, you don't know what it is until someone tells you what it is, or until you've had a period of time to look at it and let it speak to you again.
Mm.
Right? So it's like a two-stage process. So like very random things will come in and speak to you after you've done them, and you don't know why. That works, that doesn't.
Mm. Yeah, there's a lot of sense that emerges after you've finished, because at the time of doing it, you're simultaneously trying to do something that you know is ephemeral. It's just paper that's wrapped around a, a plastic disc. But the sort of ephemeral nature of the physicality of it is kind of in your head battling with the fact you're trying to make kind of art.
Well,
with a big A. Maybe it may be still lowercase, but it's massive.
Massive. Yeah. Well, I'd make the assumption that it would free you up knowing that it's not for an exhibition, it is for the album art. But I guess there's more pressure, is there, for that?
No, it's really, I guess we have always come to it a little bit backwards. I mean, the normal experience that people have when they're working on a record is that, like, someone will come in at the end and, you know, say, oh, what about this? And they have a selection on the table and that's it. You know, and sometimes that really works. You know, Sonic Youth of, you know, Gerhard Richter, they've had great covers.
Mike Kelly, yeah.
Yeah. So sometimes that works. But I went to art school and I met Mr. Donwood there, and it never, but at the same time, I was always really resistant to think of it as in terms of art.
Yeah.
Because, partly because, especially at that time, we had a penchant for self-annihilation and anything that we were doing.
So no change there, really.
Yeah, not really. OK Computer had been very, very successful. And we literally scratched that together because we had to. And the record company were like super nervous about us being in charge of it all. But it was incredibly fun to have all that support and, like, that, you know, be doing big billboards up the M4 off the Westway saying, you know, Gucci screaming little piggy, whatever, things like that. And they said yes. You know, things like that, but it wasn't. No, that's art. It's all commercial. This is not art. This is something we're feeding a commercial monster, so we can sort of negate, we can sort of dismiss it to some extent. It's like a defense mechanism.
Yeah.
And then when it got to Kid A and Amnesiac and sort of piecing it all together, still the sort of defense mechanism was there, like, I don't know, is this art? And then afterwards, when we were putting it together and it was going out into the world and Mr. Dunn was being asked to, like, oh, we need an ever here or we need this here. And suddenly you were putting that stuff back into the world and seeing it in magazines, like these weird cartoons and stuff. Mm. And I was realizing, oh, maybe this is art. Maybe this is art. I mean, it sort of hid from me personally. I was hiding behind the idea. It was like, oh, we're just generating stuff to put on a cover. Oh. Whatever, 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 whatever. And then at some point, I'm like, okay, it's more than that.
Yeah. Well, it was never an afterthought, was it? That's the thing, I think, for everyone listening, is that you came to the decision that you would be in the studio, Stanley, at the same time as the music was being made. So there was, and you would hear the songs being recorded. So then you were able to work while you was listening to the music. So there is this harmony that comes together of, like, as pictures and words go together as harmonious in real life.
Well, it's a lot easier to make pictures if the music's already made them for you. You've just got to find out what they look like and then do that.
Yeah.
Mm. And that's the difficult bit is, but because the band of making the music, that's difficult. So you're all doing the difficult bit together. And then you sort of get to a point where it's, you've figured something out. And it's, I don't know, there's a sort of moment of reaching a plateau and going, oh my God, I can stop feeling so ghastly. And I can relax a bit.
There was an awful lot of self-doubt going on.
Oh, man, yeah, I mean, it's horrible.
Going through all the stuff that we wrote during that period, it was extraordinary that we even got out of bed.
It's excruciating, frankly. Yeah. Just the level of self-doubt is, you know, you'd just done a, you know, OK Computer had been really successful.
But it was a defence, like I said, I guess, it was a defence mechanism. It was a way of, like, what you're trying to do is second-guess...
Yeah.
Making a mistake. So you're like, okay, I'm going to destroy this before it happens, just in case.
What, self-sabotage?
Yeah. Constant self-sabotage of everything you're doing. Hence the two-stage process. So it's like you can't possibly like do something, see it through to the end, go, wow, I'm brilliant, great, move on. It was like, do
nice
something,
that would
hate
have been.
It. What?
That would have been nice. Have been,
who actually does it, though, and no, makes good work, fair. Makes
exactly.
good art?
That's I mean, that's... Yeah, it's the same in any... Yeah.
But what I liked is that you would make the visuals and then you would come in and you'd fuck them up and then you would then come in and fuck what he's
absolutely.
Done up.
Absolutely,
and it
yeah.
would end up being a battle for who wins the painting yeah. in the end. And oh, that, no,
well, yes, except that, you know, it was always... only one of us has any patience or commitment to what they're doing, and that's not me.
But you would throw it around the room,
well,
right?
No, yeah, my patience commitment is much more to twiddling with knobs on a synthesizer.
I mean, to be stuff. Fair, he has got to go away and make the music, you know. Yeah, so I've, yeah. you know, when he's doing that, I sneak back.
So it was, you know, exactly,
and then work over right. what Tom's yeah, been
yeah,
doing.
Yeah, yeah. I'd flit over I'd that. Flit in a flitting way. Grab yeah. a paintbrush. Go, what about this?
No. Was there any ego with that? Was that tough to begin with? Because you're like, hang on a minute, stay in your lane.
No, I kind of like it because it's... I mean, I think we're sort of like two... We're quite opposite in the way that we approach making marks, I think. Because although I try to be a kind of expressive, abandoned, sort of emotionally driven mark maker... I do tend to end up cross-hatching quite a lot. So, you know, I do need a kind of...
That's your default, is to cross-hatch.
Yeah, yeah. Really detailed. So I do need a maniac to come in every now and again.
But you would have a pseudonym as Dr. Chock. So the works that you've got... You've
oh, we lots
on. So you have lots of... Well, pseudonym, like yeah. Stanley, your
Sunday
your
Painters
name is Dan.
Was always my favourite. Yeah.
The Sunday Painters.
Sunday Painters, pure.
I liked one of the best ones we had was End Games Envisioned yeah. by Dumb Computers. That was the best yeah. one.
Mm-hmm.
And that's yeah. you come
that's
up with that
the
title.
Most catchy one.
Yeah. You come up with that title together.
No, that was totally him.
I think that was... What about we were Zachariah Wildwood and Donald Twain once?
Oh, that was a good one. Although I always wanted... Which one was I?
You wanted to be Zachariah, but we both wanted to be Zachariah. Nobody wanted to be Donald.
Yeah.
This was, of course, before Donald.
These are the conversations we have over email.
Yeah.
The thing I love about your connection is that you guys met each other when you were really young and like still forming your whole universes creatively, but you've sort of stuck together. Oh. And it's quite an unusual thing. And I think for we have a lot of younger listeners, like younger artists all over the world. And I always say to them, like, your peer group and the people you actually, you know, grew up with, at least at art school and stuff like that, can be really sort of a really great thing to hold on to. It's not always like you need to sort of become successful and then you'll work with the big music video director or then you'll work with a great graphic designer or,
yeah,
you know, well, do it all properly. Well, it's like actually create something new.
To be fair,
he's done that as well.
Okay, yeah, you know, he has.
to me, like, I am, if I'm totally honest with myself, leave me to my own devices, I just get lost. Mm. Like, I'm a collaborator. I have to collaborate. You know, I have essentially the attention span of an insect, and which is why, you know, I can go into the painting studio, pick up the paintbrush, go, what about this? It's something, you know, and then walk away because I can't see it through, right? This is the point. I can't see it through. I can musically, but I vastly prefer doing that with other people. When I get feedback so that I because I'm not very sure of myself. So that kind of feedback can make you stop going around in circles and be sure of yourself and take a direction and move forward, you know. So I've always been like that. But I also secretly think that anybody who says that the creative process is this solo tortured process is kind of lying. You know, it doesn't really matter who it is. You could, even someone like Edvard Munch, you can say, well, yes, maybe he worked on his own, but he was very influenced by the people around him. You know, everybody has somebody they go to ask, what does this mean? What do you think? Blah, blah, blah. Everybody does.
Unless it's someone like Henry Darger. But they're
like self-taught.
All right, yeah, I'll give you that.
They're not happy people.
Yeah, all right, fair enough.
You know, but that's a kind of what do you call it, like some a mental state that you're in if someone like him. But yeah, I agree with you. I can't work alone. Well, I can obviously, but I'm always saying, what about this? Is this any good? Because I can't tell.
Yeah, you have to be, when you work alone, you have to be both the audience and the creator, and that is difficult to do. It means you have to be able to put stuff on the wall or put stuff on a table and listen to it and figure out, where am I at with this? I don't know where I am. It's a long process when you do it on your own, you know?
So this thing when artists say, I make the work for myself, that isn't the case for you. You're always considering an audience.
No, it's not about considering the audience in the sense of pleasing them. Yeah. It's like having someone to help you reflect, to have a mirror so you can see what it looks like in the mirror. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? Like, no, I don't. If we were doing this to please people, we've gone probably another hour. Okay. I could give you a list of names, but anyway. Yeah.
So you guys met at Exeter University, but prior before that, you was a fire eater.
No, that was after. I took that up after because there's a, you know, there's this sort of revolving door between art college and the Dole, and it's I was on income support for what felt like a considerable period of time, so I took up a busking to augment my income. So yeah, that was.
Busking, fire eating.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But out of busking, you could have done many things. How come you chose fire eating? That's quite dramatic.
It's much easier than any sort of music. Okay. Yeah.
Can you still do it?
I wouldn't, but I probably could do it. Yeah, I know how to do it, but it's not very good for you.
Yeah, I think your partner would have something to say about
that. Yeah, she does not.
Not today. But then you wanted to support when your band was called Headless Chickens. This is before.
Oh, no, that was a band.
They were
called. On a Friday, so I turned up in Oxford with my mate because we were hitchhiking with the fire breathing because we were two-man fire breathers. Yeah, because when you make two jets of fire together, you make something that looks more like a kind of fiery mushroom cloud in the sky. Very impressive.
See, that's a collaboration again.
Yeah. So yeah, we turned up in Oxford and there was a poster up on a Friday. I'm like, that's my mate from uni.
Oh wow,
he's in that band. So we don't know phone box. Phoned up.
That's right. Like that. Slept on our floors.
Slept on your floor. Went on the floor. Went to the show.
The dirty floor.
The dirty floor. Where Colin was doing English lessons or something.
That's right, yes. Anyway.
Yeah, a long time ago.
But then you weren't allowed the job to work.
Well, it was a stupid idea. You can't do fire breathing indoors. It's really dangerous.
Tom, you were actually making artwork yourself back then, and I heard that you were really interested in the Mac computer, like, you know, back then, and you did something called When I Grow Up in 1991.
Wow.
And I was looking at like these stills of it, and because apparently it's actually been lost as an artwork now because the format it was on kind of disintegrated or something.
It's a little bit more, it's a little bit more convoluted. I mean, I did all this work and it got basically, I went through sort of every department at art school and didn't do very well until I sort of got to video. I was really into video, but I could never get all the cameras, so I would do a lot of editing. I got really into chopping things up. And then the graphics department was next door, and they just arrived, all these Apple Macs arrived one day. I was like, that's me, I'm in on that. So I sort of broke into the graphics department.
Wow.
And then I was only working in there, and then... I inadvertently took up half their hard disk space.
Which wasn't much.
It wasn't much. And arrived at the beginning of my final year to discover all my work had been wiped. So, and that's not the first time that's happened. Last time that's happened either. Anyway. So I ended up, it was weird. I ended up working on computers and writing my thesis on where I thought computers would relate to art and all this sort of stuff. So it's
We was early into computers.
But then they it was frowned upon, and the fine art department was told after I left that they couldn't use the
graphics. Oh god, I didn't know that.
Wow. Breath Now, it's so different.
Well, yeah. I don't know. Yeah. Kind of still, I mean, NFTs is happening, but there is a kind of frowning upon from like the analog side of the art world.
Yeah, but that's we're not gonna spend an hour talking about NFTs.
That is a whole hour, yeah.
But see, the essence of where I got to with my thesis was like, well, the entire art establishment is based on this concept of an original artifact.
Yeah.
If you remove that, you cannot add value to it. Therefore, what's going to happen to it? And we're still there.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, pulling off your hair and putting it in a box with the with a USB drive doesn't really cut it to me. Mm. Anyway.
You know, there's always been this sense as well within your work that there's a kind of dystopian world, but also a utopian world. And I heard you mention the word portent and this idea of kind of like an omen of some kind. But for me, it's kind of a mix between the two, because it's not like a good omen or a bad omen. I feel like there's kind of all sides of life within your work. But can you talk a bit about that idea of like utopia or dystopia?
Well, there was a lot of that going around when we were doing that artwork, you know, 20 odd years ago, wasn't there?
Mm.
It was, the millennium was coming up.
Yes, it was. And as with all millennium events, there's a lot of panic, really.
Yes.
And, I didn't realise this, but at the time, we were, you know, there was the millennium bug and the idea of the rapture. All these things were the hardcore evangelical thinking was reaching a sort of frenzied crescendo. And if this happened in the year 1000 as well, which is like, I had no idea. And you know, of course, they were building the dome. There were all these things to mark this kind of arbitrary but monumental moment. That was, you know, so it was, it, you know, the ideas of utopia and dystopia are completely entwined.
We were also completely obsessed with genetically modified things.
Yeah, because that was new then. It's kind of hard to remember that all of this was new, and our ways of finding out about it had just become the internet.
Yeah.
That was new as a way to find out about stuff. You know, it had existed for, you know, four or five years before, but around the year 2000, it had suddenly become like Barclays were on the internet. You could There was the
what you're banking.
I remember the moment I was like, Barclays are on the internet. Oh, it's fucked, man. This is going to be a nightmare, because it was a utopian ideal that the internet was going to be this transformational medium in human existence, like, you know, movable type, like the printing press. You know, and of course, I naively thought it was going to be a force for good, but in fact, it's turned into a giant shopping mall with.
I also think there was a lot of the portent thing was also had this weird thing at that time for us about a weird sort of twisted politics to what we were doing. Mm. We are naturally lefty, but it was equally the success working within a corporate EMI type thing. The advent of the internet we saw at the time as some sort of hope, but at the same time we were just taking the piss out of all those kind of ideas as much as we could, and taking the piss out of consumption as much as we could. You know, anti-globalization was something that was the property of the left rather than the right at the time. There was something about the genetically modified thing that became, we wanted to use that as a joke, so it became about these genetically modified bears. So it's like this innocent child creature which is not in fact innocent at all. And this all got sort of tied up into this odd narrative, which was, if you sort of step back from it, it was like an anger at a certain type of movement, globalization and dislocation of the people from the world around them. And somehow we were being told, it's okay because we're all going to transform. There's going to be this moment where we all transform into some form of higher being that there was this idea that somehow technology was going to take us to this new and beautiful place. And me and him were just sitting there going, fuck off!
There's all, the, all of those sorts of things, like, you know, Blair's third way, neoliberalism, the opposition to sort of multinationals, big pharmaceutical companies, and globalization, which are now firmly being owned by the rather rabid side of the right wing, were, like Tom says, it's kind of, that was, they were all left-wing concerns. It seems really weird now how that has happened and what has enabled that shift, because it's pretty fundamental. There's been some sort of fulcrum where all of these concerns have just been taken away from the left wing.
There was Genoa.
Yeah.
Seattle.
Yeah. There were loads of demonstrations against the G7, the World Trade Organization, all this stuff. And now I'm thinking about it going, oh, my God. Mm. You know, in retrospect, it's kind of like, how could that have happened? But, of course, it's a real concern still that, you know, power has been taken away from people and concentrated ever more in tinier and tinier corporations and groups of people. Mm.
But this energy and ideas was going into the visuals at the time. So you look at them, like completely. Rob said in the intro, like this kind of time capsule. You look at them now, so it's a historical time capsule for the state of the world, but also the state of mind that you were in at that moment.
But it's also still relevant to this day. Yeah. Like, that's the interesting thing about it.
I'm much better.
Kind of, there are still elements, though, of, like, you know, it's human nature, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it was just a difficult time in lots of ways, kind of. What was around and what was inside, it was not my favourite part of my life. Mm. So I think
we're both having our own particular crisis about
how
we related to the world.
Yeah.
At your most kind of successful.
That's often the case, I think.
But because we've just been looking back through it all and it's, you know, because I guess when we started, we just went to go and talk to the V&A, which is quite grand in the first place, and then that all fell apart, and we've gone through a global pandemic, which is, you know, doesn't happen very often in a lifetime. So we've ended up with something again completely not what we expected, but the process to get there has been really illuminating. Looking at the work of this, honestly, it's not us who did this stuff, not us now.
No.
It's some other kind of young guys, and I don't know what the hell was wrong
with
them.
Different energy.
Yeah.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
And these the imagery, as well as re-releasing the actual music itself with like unreleased songs and things, you've actually made these two books. One is with text and kind of words and drawings, and then one is more with the paintings. But if we think about the actual, like, the way it all looks, like, you had kind of mythological things like minotaurs, or then like maps, monsters, pylons, dams, volcanoes, locusts. I'm reading this, obviously.
Mountains.
Helicopters, Hiroshima, show homes, ring roads, lightning. Like, I love all these ideas, but when I read that out, it takes me back to when I first listened to those albums. And, you know, the visuals are so linked to that time.
I don't know where all those things, sort of how they came together, but...
Well, me neither. It just sort of came...
You
brought the Minotaur thing. Absolutely brought the Minotaur thing, and you brought most of it, to be honest. I mean, I was the mountains and the geometric shapes, because I just could see them all in the music everywhere we looked.
It's a visual musical thing.
Yeah. And then the Minotaur one I found really interesting because I really struggled with it for a while. I was like, why is he bringing
it? It was this city.
Yeah, and it was all about internal landscapes. This idea of a mind trapped in its own labyrinth, cannot escape, going in round and round and round and round and round. It's like that was exactly what was happening to us. I mean, we couldn't break out of this odd prison that we'd built ourselves.
Yeah, we had literally built it around ourselves.
Yeah.
And I was coming here to London and I think I was drawing with my eyes shut, drawing shapes on the A to Z and then following that shape.
That came from the Situationist thing,
yeah,
didn't it?
Yeah.
What's that mean?
In Guy Debord's...
Either in the Sight of the Spectacle or the other one.
I don't know. There was this whole thing that the Situationists, apparently, one of the things they did would they would go for a stroll around Paris. Was it? Did they use a dice or did they just pick it?
I think they'd write a name, their name, on the map of Paris and then try to follow that as precisely as possible.
Oh, the other one I read was just that you just walk and every time you got to a junction, they'd just walk blindly through Paris, not without any awareness of where you're going. And when you got to a junction, you choose.
Yeah.
And that's it. And you just do that as a...
Like flipping a coin.
To see where your mind... To see how it would free you up. Or what.
Like a sliding doors sort of
exercise? I guess, yeah. So I was trying to do sort of automatic writing, let something else talk. You know,
we were both doing it, yeah.
And then...
On A to Z maps.
Oh, yeah. No,
yeah. I wasn't.
But then it was...
On A to Z.
And I was trying to sort of find out what... I was trying to discover something... Yeah. I didn't know what it was. So I had this little video camera. I was making all these really, really, really boring films of London. And so I had all these old guidebooks from the beginning of the 20th century.
Yeah.
So they were describing a London that wasn't even there. So it was really weird. And I came across Piranesi, the artist from whenever he was, like 17th century or something.
Italian.
Yeah, Giovanni Battista Piranesi. And he was most famous for doing these huge etchings of imaginary prisons, which, just looking across at St. Pancras over there, that building wouldn't be out of place in those. So that, you know, these imaginary prisons. Prisons, yes. Mm. You know, they were called the Carceri, I think, in Italian. I don't know.
Did he have an experience of being incarcerated?
No, not at all. He was an architect.
Oh,
don't know. Exactly. I don't know why I was doing this. I don't know why he was doing it.
Yeah.
I don't know why, you know, it was just one of these strange
For me, the prison thing was quite clear now when looking back, because the prison thing was basically I'd spent a long time... I don't know if you know this. You probably experience this sometimes. You know, if you go on the promo trail, right, you got to plug something. Mm. After day three of talking in cursory language, superficial, blah, 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 interviews, you start to sort of internalize that a little bit. It's hard to resist. I started to internalize that state of mind, that idea of like, I'd go into my little tiny studio at home, I'd start work, and in the internal monologue would be there, like little speech bubbles, doing, I'm doing this because I like to da-da-da. I'm already explaining it.
You're commenting on your life.
I'm commenting on my life. I'm judging every single creative decision I'm making.
It's a lot. It's hectic.
It's a lot. Yeah. After many, many years of you know, my glorious record company put me on the promo trail, I'd started to totally internalize it. And also the success itself, I found really like I'm not genetically built to internalize that in a good way, right? Mm-hmm. It was odd. I remember I was working with Polly Harvey briefly around that time, and I said to her, I've really been struggling with this work thing. It's like the more successful I've become, the more I just am pathological about working. I just can't stop. I just feel guilty. She said, yeah, I have exactly the same problem. And I think that's a cultural thing from where we're from as well. And anyway, so the prison was absolutely that.
It's
metaphorical.
Something you build yourself around yourself.
Yeah.
This, you know, because I was seeing it in its physical form, London as a massive labyrinth. Mm. And then the fact that this mythology, that something like the Minotaur in its labyrinth or maze has just stuck around since the time of ancient Crete. And it still makes sense. And the monster that we're scared of, the monster is us. The monster is always ourselves. The prison is always of our own manufacture.
But you're not aware of this at the time, obviously. This is like looking at it like pop psychology afterwards. But looking at the work now, you must pull it out and be like you're saying, you don't recognise this. But that what you did at that time was channel these anxieties.
Well, no, not consciously, but sort of like, I was like, right, okay.
Imagine how unbearable if it was conscious. It would be.
Right.
It would be absolutely tosh.
It's affected. It's affected then, isn't it? The best art comes out of that place. Like the artists you're drawn to, like Edvard Munch, for example.
Yeah, you work despite
Hieronymus Bosch. It's like these come out of hell.
Your work comes out despite you, not because of you.
Yes.
Right. Can we talk a bit about the materiality of some of the things you were doing? Because I heard you were like making paintings with knives, which obviously quite frenzied in itself.
Well, yeah, but you know, knives come in many sorts. These were like palette knives. You know, they're flat, blunt, thin metal knives. But rather than brushes, it wasn't. I think this was it's a reaction against the idea of art with its capital A. You know, being a kind of rarefied. Posh sort of thing, I suppose. So
there's also quite an interesting element.
Big work.
Yeah, this is the thing, because maybe one thing we haven't talked about is like we'd worked exclusively on computers, and then but we discovered like we'd started like literally started by going, oh well, I'll just scan in some sketches and I'll try and collage together some photos, and there you go. And then suddenly you're like, well, hang on a minute, the most exciting bit about this is definitely not working on the computer, it's bringing in stuff from the real world into the computer and chopping it up and mashing it around. So the physicality of creating these enormous canvases and then reducing them down and manipulating them was super exciting.
And one of my favourite things was we have these huge paintings that deliberately a massive canvas, so you could wipe your whole sleeve over it, you can kick it, you can throw stuff at it and it will stick, all of that. And then you're able to, in those days, you know, photograph it with a film camera, and then you have a print that's then you scan on a scanner. And Nigel Godrich, who was producing the music, making it all stick together, was he was working on this early version of 3D software. So what we could do was get a photograph of a real painting that exists in 3D, turn that into a bump map, black and white sort of
terrain,
and then you sort of like float down the colour of it as if it's a kind of quilt over this landscape, and then
you could travel through it.
You get this artificial flying camera that flies through this terrain event. And then you can take photos of that.
Exactly.
It's fucking mental.
So the sort of at the time we weren't necessarily thinking about the paintings as final composition.
No.
Right. We were thinking of them as source material.
They're totally amazing.
They're like gateways.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what freaked me out when we started using this light wave, what it was like I've been having these weird visions. Not a bad thing, actually, a good thing. It's something about healing. But I'd been having these visions of these fragmented landscapes and of these mountains. So the cover of Kid A ended up, by accident, being really quite close to this vision that I had. And when we first started moving through these landscapes, there they were, these fragmented landscapes, exactly as I'd seen them. And just being produced by this software, it was super exciting to sort of see something before it actually happened.
So, but you would go from the analog into the digital,
work
on it, and then you'd put it back into the analog.
It stayed digital because you know at that time, the CD was the paramount
the ending. That was the conception.
A vehicle for music. It was everywhere.
I guess it gets printed into the CD booklet, though. Yeah. In the sense that then becomes material again, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's and that
Whereas
was it. That's
days, what it's all in. You know, iTunes or Spotify.
iTunes or Spotify or vinyl back again. You know,
yeah,
so
yeah, yeah.
So you mentioned the modified bear earlier on, which is the spiky toothed,
yeah,
unfriendly, friendly bear that on everybody's homework for many years was drawn by school kids up and down the country. Where did that come from? Did that come from a place of wanting to find a logo, or did it just appear and then it became like?
I was like, my kids were really tiny at the time, and I was, you know, they wake up at a basically illegal hour in the morning. It's disgusting how early they wake up. It's really horrible.
When you're just getting in, right?
Oh, man, it's so bad. So kind of get up and I sort of tell stories and I draw the little, here's the thing from the story. And that was one of, that's what happens. The idea was with that story was that when children are little, they have all these bears and they love them, all their toys. They love their toys and they're all friends and they talk to each other and everything like that. And then they grow up and they put all their toys in the attic and they're downstairs talking about mortgages and double glazing and kind of investments.
Yeah.
And the toys get really angry and they come down the stairs and they
kill all the grown-ups.
They eat the grown-ups. So that was...
Kill all the grown-ups.
Yeah. So that was the illustration of what happens to a bear if you kind of ignore it and talk about mortgages for too long.
And did you show this? This you drew for your children at the time?
Yeah,
and you went, did you scare them at the time?
No. They're fine.
They're fine with that. But then that became like your image for so long.
Like a central kind
still
of motif.
Is, yeah, like a motif to you.
It was just, you know, probably it was just some.
Probably it was just a t-shirt design or something.
I think what normally happens is we don't see each other for a while, and then we throw it, and then we sit down. This used to happen before we used computers a lot. We just throw each other our sketchbooks and just sit there for the afternoon going, I like this, what's this, blah, blah, blah.
Critique each other.
And just really grabbing that, stuff. And that just really, this idea of this innocence, lost innocence, childhood thing was like, wow, that's amazing, you know. And so it became really integrated into it all.
Your opinion of the art world now, because you seem quite self-deprecating about your own work and you kind of separate
I got a bit better at that. But
It's all relative.
But how do you feel about, like, you're going to have this show at Christie's now, and how do you feel about the actual art world? Do you go and visit museums and look at other artists' work, like contemporary? Because you definitely reference historic history of art.
Yes. But I can't quite. It's doing my nut in, to be honest, that we've got this work in a really fancy part of a really fancy part of London. It's not just Mayfair. It's a really, really posh bit of Mayfair.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I don't know. I think I am kind of in a state of denial about that at the moment.
Me too.
Yeah. It feels slightly like a Trojan horse or something to me.
Yeah.
And even the title, How to Disappear Completely, it's one of the best song titles ever written. But you know, if you think about our modern culture, I love the fact that it's outside of Christie's during Freeze Week, which is when no gallerist, no artist or anybody can hide. But I love this idea of disappearing completely. It's like...
I had to think of a title quickly.
Think of a title quickly.
It's about auction houses as well. Is it really democratic? It's the fact that people don't realise you can go into previews. Everybody
is
welcome. These are artworks that
we didn't know this.
Museums don't have, and
we didn't know. Yeah, they have this stuff that museums can't afford, and you can just walk in and look at it. Yeah.
And also,
and
stuff
it changes
that's been
every
hidden
2 weeks
in people's homes Vault. For like 50 years, and then suddenly it, you know, unearthed again.
Yeah, I know. It's amazing. And if I was like an art tutor or something, that's one of the first things I'd say. Go to London, all of those galleries. You can go into any of them.
Mm.
Any of them. Auction houses, any of them. Just walk in.
Mm. Yeah.
They can't stop you. It's fine. Go and look at it.
I think the interesting thing about it is because the work was for record sleeves, right? It's been quite a weird journey. When we did talk to galleries or whatever, when you talked to galleries, it was... I kind of felt sorry for him because, for us in a way, because it's like, well, they're not going to judge this. They're going to only judge this under the cloud of the music. Mm. They're only going to see it like that. And normally, an artist has a story. There's a development. There's a way it's happened, a narrative that's happened within the artistic community somehow or other. But this narrative happened in another area completely. So how are you going to judge it? Yeah. How are you going to evaluate it? Is it going to get any respect because it's basically done for a commercial enterprise, you know? But then again, what the hell difference is it?
What art is not commercial?
So much of the politics of galleries is reassuring the investor that what they're buying is going to be worth more because the artist is so-called up-and-coming or represents this or this. Based on a myth or some story that they develop around that artist, you know? And that to me is like, well, why is that any better? Why is that any different? You know, anyway.
Well, the myth of Stanley Donwood.
There is one.
There is one.
Is there?
Yeah.
I don't know. I have to work it out.
This this attention to detail, this kind of harmony between music and images and art is very rare. But it reminds me of another artist that we had on, Michael Stipe from REM. Yeah, who I know is a massive influence to you. Yes. And it feels like you're... He came along and he's someone that you look to, but you've sort of taken his kind of baton and moved it on with your own narrative. But he's definitely someone that was meticulous with everything at every moment of REM, the designing, the drawing, the concert sets, the posters, everything.
Yeah, that,
the ephemera.
And it shows, right?
Totally shows.
And even like he worked with like Howard Finster's you know, artwork as the sleeve.
Yeah.
I love that whole story. We were talking about that recently.
But he was a big influence, and then you actually went and supported him, right?
Yeah. We talked with him for, I mean, he's a really good friend of mine. But it was a very odd journey for me, you know, because from the age of 15, 16, I discovered Murmur, the first proper full-length album, and a cover, which she explained to me later, was this kind of weed that they get outside Athens, which just looked like another world. You know, he's a photographer, and he has this particular eye, which is still really, I find, really unusual. And we used to, when I was on tour with him, he always had his little contacts camera, always shooting, always taking photographs, still does, has as much a visual eye as a musical ear. But more even than that, it was his approach to every aspect, centrally lyrics, but every aspect of the way that they worked. I just thought, like, it was a sort of liberation for me that there wasn't anybody else quite like that I was listening to, that was like coming from, not even from like art school, just from total outsider. You know, Michael, that whole community of artists, and so they're really outsider stuff. It wasn't like, we're all going to art school and like we got like a whole shtick worked out. They were like, no, they were really out there, really properly out there. I went to a couple of odd parties and stuff, you know. But it was strange for me because I was a teenager, and then suddenly, not that long after, we were hanging out on tour and I was watching him every night and watching how they did stuff. And that and my increasing obsession with like, krautrock and this different way of looking at what you're creating, it all sort of synthesized, you know. And
What was that? Can and what rock?
Krautrock, you know, krautrock. The whole sort of that school of music in the 70s, where they were just totally coming from a different point of view about how they worked. There's a really great biography of Can, which I can't remember the name of right now, which started reading. It's bonkers. I'm getting off the point. Michael was like a license for me to be that person, you know. Like, there was two people when I was a teenager that sort of like I felt, apart from maybe my teachers, that gave me the freedom to be that person. And one of them was him. And the other one was Neil Young. Because I'd never heard Neil Young. And Neil Young, I sent in like this demo tape to a magazine and they came back saying, who's this guy? This is amazing. They gave me like lead review and said, he sounds like Neil Young. I'm like, who the fuck's Neil Young? So these two people arrive in my life and I end up meeting them both and I ended up being a close friend of Michael's, and it informed a lot of, not just me, you know, the rest of the band got to know R.E.M. and they were commercial, very successful, but their whole mentality about what they were doing was so backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards. It was so inspiring that it meant that we sort of would go back to our huge corporate entity, EMI, and say, well, R.E.M. can do it, so can we do it? You know, it was always that kind of argument. Anyway, I'm waffling. We'll probably cut all that out.
No, we won't. He gave you some advice, like you were saying, about when you were touring around and everything, like doing stuff for press, is that I'm not here, this isn't really happening.
Which is where How to Disappear came from, yeah. I was going through a... after OK Computer, I was always basically catatonic. I mean, properly catatonic. I would stop mid-song on stage, and I can't even tell you why, but I just couldn't do it anymore. I remember doing a show in the NEC in Birmingham, and after soundcheck, I just walked off and tried to find the train out to try and get out of there.
Was you here at this point? Are you witnessing all this?
No, I don't go on the tour in.
Right. No. So
By the time they're doing that, I've totally had enough.
Yeah.
So it's.
But do you have each other's backs at these points as like companions throughout this whole journey together?
No, that was, to an extent, but yeah. I mean, it's kind of like it's a different life because we work together when doing the making, but the touring. I don't think I've come around.
I remember you coming on to New York at the end of the tour.
I handed you very high. Yeah.
I'd been smoking that for months.
Jesus Christ! Yeah,
and I was like, oh shit! I knew I was worried because I handed one to you, and you were flat out on the floor straight off.
We went to that. I've been mad doing that club like, where that bloke was being whipped by a.
That might have been Rob.
It's not fair.
Yeah. Wow, no, it was mental. And I was just, that was the first time I'd ever been on an aeroplane.
Whoa.
Yeah, and I went to New York City. I got different very, lines. Very high. Yeah.
But how did Michael's mantra manifest for you then, you were saying? So you.
It was a form of self-protection, really. There was a few things he taught me. One was like... to be in when you're in a situation you can't get out of it, you just disengage, you know. I ended up realizing that that you can only do that for so long, it ends up being quite dangerous, you've got to be careful. But anyway, at the time it helped. And the other thing was he had this trick that he could make himself invisible.
Yeah. I remember you doing that.
We used to do it in New York. Yeah. I remember going to a club in Stockholm and we're like, okay, let's do the invisible. So we just went and nobody bothered us. We just decided, we told ourselves we're invisible and nobody bothered us. Nobody said anything.
Wow.
He was really good at it. He was really good at it.
Because anyway, I remember Tom telling me about that. That
make was, yourself visible.
Yeah. Oh God. Yeah. He would do that just to show me.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you remember we
did it in a bar together.
Yeah.
When we were about 27 or something and we were in New York and he said to me, watch me now, I'm going to make the bar look at me. And I was like, don't be ridiculous, because I was saying to him no one was like finding me attractive. Uh-huh. And he was like, I'll show you how to get everyone to think you're attractive, because he's obviously an actor. Uh-huh. And he literally just changed his body posture.
Yeah.
Changed everything, and then within a minute the whole Whoa. Room was looking at him. Yeah. And suddenly everyone recognized him from some show.
That's
he was
right.
on and
Whoa.
But before that no one had even recognized us. Mm-hmm. That was the night Khalees was performing a cappella yeah. live before it had even aired anywhere.
Yeah.
And I remember hearing that song and being like, this is like the new kind of disco hit, like yeah. as in like you know classic disco. Yeah. It was like the modern disco. I love that record, a cappella. Such a good one, like in a gay club. It was like the perfect venue.
I think invisibility is very useful. I wish I could do that.
Anyway,
it'd be really good.
Where were we? I'm lost.
Properly.
I'm totally lost.
Let's talk about one thing. So in your lifetime, there's been a number of artists. You mentioned Polly Harvey and also people like Björk, who to me, like yourself, are kind of pioneers. I almost imagine you guys on a mountain somehow, like a metaphorical mountain, like hiking, you know, to the next new idea. What's it been like to like collaborate with Björk? And also, are you ever aware of any of this kind of pioneering thing? Or is it just you guys you know, living your life?
There's a few there. I'll start with the Bjork and Polly thing. That was very much cursory, like just roll up and walk briefly into someone else's universe. And it's a very intimate sort of place. It's like, I didn't feel that comfortable. I'm not really comfortable with it, but it was really fascinating to watch. And they both are great artists, and they worked in the way that I would expect. And took what they're doing extremely seriously, which was great. In terms of being whatever innovator or whatever, I think I would go back to the first thing we talked about. Is that I don't. If you sit down in a creative space and you say, "Today I'm going to innovate," you are naturally not going to be. You're not going to do anything new or interesting. So all you're trying to do is find something that speaks to you at that time, and usually that involves trying to go somewhere new, because that's where you need to go, but only new to you. Because the trap is always comparing what you're doing to other things, and that's when you get into this the only way to sort of cope with that, I think we both had this, is that you have to sort of have to have like a kind of bluffer, sort of amateur stroke beginner's mind mentality to what you're doing. Because if you start to
act as an expert
or professional,
you get anywhere.
Yeah, you tend to die out pretty quick. Because, I mean, going back to the example of when we took these paintings and they were turned into, Nigel turned them into these terrains that we could explore. Like if someone who knew that software came in, they would literally laugh at us for what we were doing, because technically it was by no means brilliant, but it spoke to us and it gave us something that then informed what we did.
And we got, you know, the only way we could get save any of it was literally press three buttons on the keyboard to get a screen grab.
Yeah, so literally with screen grabbing.
All you've got is, and you know, it's 72 dpi is very low resolution. So if you're, and then you print that as a, you know, an actual record cover, it looks like it's pixelated. Well, we've already blown it up as well, but that was one of the things that we loved from early video games, was when you go around a corner, you get close to it, it just turns into, you know, pixels the size of fists, you know, it's amazing. So you kind of, there's this weird thing, it's almost like we were trying to create a world where the bones of it, the skeleton of it, was still visible. You could see what it's made of, you know, even if you make the pixels that big, then even the ones over there that are really tiny, you know they're, you know, how it's constructed.
I mean, as an actor, right, you have to come to each different character from a completely open... You have to be open at the start to whatever you're going to find, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's the same... If you come to that with this kind of, I know what I'm doing, attitude, you're blocking yourself before you start.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be prepared to make a shit ton of mistakes before you find what you need. It's the same. It's the same thing. You have to be prepared to make those mistakes, and you have to be prepared, for me, for example, you have to be prepared to buy a new piece of equipment, not understand it at all, and mess around on it until something speaks to you, and not be hung up about the fact you don't know what you're doing. Not give yourself a hard time. Because if you fall into that, you know, that's what I mean about this innovator idea.
Yeah.
It's like the joke is to innovate, you have to retain this weird kind of innocence.
Love that.
Mm.
And vulnerability, really.
I just love the idea that we're going to go into the studio and just say, what should we do today? Let's innovate.
There's an amazing quote here that you've said, Stanley. I think, I don't know if it's relevant for both of you, but it says that it's not a career, but a series of accidents.
Mm.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
That's putting us down, because we did have to make some choices along the way at some point.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. I don't know when I said that, or
in your self-deprecating moment.
Did I? Yes. Well, there have been some of those, but I think it's quite What I like is being able to just jettison everything, as we've done loads of times. And this happens, you know, because I'm sitting there listening to what's happening musically. And I'm not a musical person at all, but I can hear they're just kind of like, that's going in the bin. That's going in the bin.
You can tell when you hear the record.
Just, yeah, that's what happened to that thing. But, you know, you can hear, you know, they're obviously talking about it. Shall we try it without that, or shall we, you know? But it always, there's always like a kind of trace of the idea left behind.
Right.
So I think something that happened to me when I was at Foundation course years ago when I was like 19. We had the first term of art school Foundation course. I was like, yeah, first time you're not at school anymore. It's brilliant. And everyone's just making this stuff. And so everyone's kind of, you know, theoretically quite good at drawing because, you know, you got into art school.
Yeah.
So at the end of the first term, like the tutor said, okay, we're going to take everything out the back here and we're going to look at it all. We're going to make we made a big pile of everyone's artwork and then they set fire to it.
No.
It was amazing.
Wow.
It was the best thing ever. Kind of like some people were very, very upset, but
yeah.
It was just all of your work that you'd spent 3 months doing just poof. And they were like, right, okay.
They wouldn't do that now.
I know they wouldn't.
They get sued now.
But it was absolutely brilliant, and I've never forgotten it because it just makes, because it's, for one thing, it kind of sets you up for one of the
release
hard drive failures.
Oh, yeah.
But also, it's just a wonderful thing to have in your head that all of this stuff that you've made, you can just jettison it. Because if it's worth it, anything, you'll do it again and you'll probably do it better.
Right. Yeah.
And also, you know, when you go back retrospectively and you look at a bunch of stuff and you have to be honest with yourself and say, I have no recollection of how this happened. It's kind of the same thing.
Yeah.
It's like the process of doing it is kind of the point, ultimately. The pleasure comes from the process. And once it's finished with the music, you hand it over and you say goodbye. And literally, if you're like me, you completely forget it. You know, I mean, I forget how that happened.
Mm-hmm.
That's the magic of art, isn't it?
I love this idea of like spontaneity and subconscious mixed with like rigor kind of mental decisions. Do you know what I mean? Like the contrasting sides of the mind almost.
It's quite yes. I don't know how other artists kind of do this kind of thing. I don't know how other people relate to their work. I mean, because again, this is in the context of some record sleeves. So it's always a bit different for us.
Yeah, and I think that's been a deliberate sidestepping of it being art in a gallery sense.
Mm. What are you going to do when you start being seen as... Well, you are seen as an artist, even if you don't see it yourself. Yeah. If you start having exhibitions now of these works, how are you going to factor that into your thinking?
I don't know. No, I've been doing exhibitions for a while, yeah. You know, of various kinds in various places. To various levels of success or failure, but it's kind of, it is something that it's like a necessary thing. It's like making music. A necessary thing is to take the music and then play it to people.
Right.
And that's the same with making pictures. The point of it is to ask people to look at it.
But, well, the fact that we work so you and me, but mostly you, work so much with the computers and with printing.
Yeah.
Means you kind of had, you've been able to sidestep that
for
a while because you're not predominantly, you know.
I mean, the thing with selling these paintings now, I haven't really seen them for 20 years. They've been in a show, a museum show, but I haven't really seen them. They're too big to go in a normal house. So I haven't really seen.
They're like 2 meters by 2 meters, aren't they? Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. So I was in the exhibition space last Friday, looking at them and really looking at them, and they're playing Kid A and Amnesiac on the.
Oh, is that okay? Great.
And I felt really weird. I felt really weird. I felt kind of almost, I don't know, not tearful, but kind of like, I've got to go, because it was too much. I was like, 20 years has just been erased. And I'm back looking at these paintings. I can look at marks on them. I can remember doing it. It's kind of like that thing is there's time.
The time
is
we've been doing that process for a while now.
Yeah.
We've had our heads shoved in ourselves 20 years ago.
Yeah, two decades ago. Like, and we've been working with it for two and a half years or something.
Yeah.
And this is the last. This is the last week of it, pretty much.
Yeah.
Is it going to be hard to let them go now? Then,
man, I'm just going to lie and watch some daytime TV.
I love that.
Yeah.
Before we get to our final questions, so someone is an early adopter of the internet, and it says here another quote: "As an early adopter of the internet, now woefully out of date, old-fashioned, and ignorant of upcoming trends."
Oh, yes, that's
how. How are you? Are you still embracing the computer? The internet for making art, or are you back to analog and print?
Oh, I just use it. No, like it's just a pencil, you know, it's a complicated pencil. I don't think I've realized, you know, in retrospect that, like Tom said earlier, what we do is put stuff that's real in front of a computer, you know, either photographed it or scanned it or whatever. But a lot of things that are made purely on a computer, I don't get anything from it, which is odd because I love computer-generated music.
I'm the same.
So,
yeah, I'm the same with the music and the art.
It has to have that analog quality before it becomes
deeply frustrating. Otherwise, I mean, much as you know, I've sat there with the iPad and tried to do the old drawing on the iPad thing,
it's David like, Hockney style.
I can't handle it, man.
It's I know, but I love David Hockney, but the iPad stuff, I'm kind of like, just get some paint, mate, please. Get some paint. Because it would be wicked if he'd done it with paint.
It's but the same with music as well, though. Like doing stuff just totally on a laptop with all internal sounds, it's like, oh, it's such a turn off. Yeah. It has to physically, there's something physical that has to happen somewhere, something in the human domain at some point.
I do really, really like technology, and I was genuinely massively excited by things like iPads and the internet and computer graphics.
It was that, you know, remember the moment where they came and they told us about PHP?
Yeah.
You know what PHP is?
No.
The PHP is where they...
It's how web pages are coded now, PHP and MySQL and I don't know, other stuff that I haven't kept up with.
We're secretly quite geeky.
Like Java, that sort of thing.
But we used to be able to write web pages. We were, all of the early versions of radio.com, we wrote with simple text, you know, or text edit or something. It was pointy brackets.
Programmed it.
IMG gap SRC equals something in common.
That's the kind of people we are. Anyway, when they came to us with the PHP, they said, hey, now you can find out where everybody's coming from and where they're going to go next and you can track them.
So yeah.
Like, why the fuck would we want to do that?
Well, yeah.
And that was it. And that's and after that, the internet became the commercial super mall it is now.
I mean, surveillance capitalism is what it is.
The new gold is your activity. That's so, PHP. That's this thing that they, we're just going to slip this into the coding now. And there's Jaron Lanier.
I hate it when you turn the computer on and suddenly it brings up something you've looked at 3 days before on some other website. And you're like, why is that there?
I read a story that really filled me with fear. And it was a guy who'd been on the run from the Chinese police. And I don't know what you have to do in China to be in trouble with the police. Probably not a great deal.
Very much, yeah.
So anyway, he's managed to escape the long arm of the Chinese law. And he's been hiding out for nearly 20 years, living in a forest somewhere. And so an unmanned drone sees a bit of something blue that has come out of his secret camp and goes and investigates. He's busted.
Oh my God.
And that's the internet. There is nowhere to hide. That's the internet. I mean, we turn on our phones with our faces. Where's that data? Who's controlling that? It terrifies me.
And he had a good 20 years, though.
Become two old men gang.
Exactly. In my day, you had to shoot people with your own hands.
I've worked with a long time with the painter and musician Billy Childish.
Uh-huh.
And Billy was a great lesson, like meeting him whenever I met him. I met him first when I was a student. But his whole thing of like all the speakers that he has, you know, the vintage speakers, and he never uses anything digital when he does his concerts. And it's amazing when you actually see one of his concerts and how it sounds. It sounds so different. And it's like a completely different energy.
Yeah.
Like you feel different molecularly watching it in the audience. It's actually like fascinating.
Yeah.
And the same with his paintings, like Edvard Munch fan as well. Like he, you know, references that, but he's made it his own thing. Yeah. So we ask every guest two questions quickly at the end. The first one is, if you could do an art heist and take any artwork from around the world or building, if you didn't want to pick an artwork, what would you choose and why? And we can help you steal it.
Yeah, we've got trucks. It could be anything. Cranes.
It means a lot to you.
Oh, it would be something Anselm Kiefer's.
Really?
Yeah.
A huge one with bits hanging off and stuff.
Yeah, like enormous.
I'll go with you. Can we have his whole place here?
Yeah, we'll take that whole place in France.
Yeah.
I don't know about this. What? Tell us about this.
He's got a whole place. Have you heard about
our listeners? Okay,
our listeners might know. He does know his place.
Yeah.
Yeah, we take the whole place and we'd... Where would we move it to somewhere nice?
Oxfordshire?
Oxford.
Well, I guess France is nice. Maybe we just move there.
Yeah.
Would you move to Essex, where you're from?
No. Really heist. We just escort him from the premises and demand that we live there instead.
Yeah.
Or you might need to keep him around, actually, because
maybe
he's constantly evolving.
Yeah, he is. Yeah, he could stay there.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, yeah, no, it's... Yeah, actually, I don't want to steal any art.
No.
Do you collect
art? Visit it.
We'll just visit it.
Do you live with each other's art?
Well, yeah, I've got some Radiohead records, it must be said.
Right.
So, you know.
But your own art? Do you have your own stuff up?
I have, yeah, yeah. I've finally got a flat big enough for one of my massive paintings.
Oh, great. Nice.
Only one, though. So.
Which one is it? Do we know?
It's from Moonshaped Pool.
It's from the Moonshaped Pool ones. Hmm. And it's a big one. And I can't remember what it's called.
The Diffy ones.
They've all got weird names.
Do you collect and live with art?
I'm... just thinking now in my early, still, 50s, that probably I should start putting things on the wall.
Yeah.
No.
It's all in storage. You do have stuff though in storage.
I don't know. I haven't done it. I'm going to start doing it.
Maybe he's got a couple of my massive paintings, but no, walls aren't big enough.
No, that's right.
He's saving them till I'm dead.
Don't ask me. I'm terrible. Really.
The other question we ask is, what is your favourite colour?
Oh, God.
Oh.
Yeah, it's basic. But it is interesting sometimes.
Oh, blue.
Yeah,
blue. Yeah?
Blue. It's the same blue.
Blue. Yeah, it's really annoying.
Like an Russian. Ice blue, like a mountain ice blue.
Prussian blue, right?
Prussian blue, I quite like Prussian blue. You know, like a new pair of jeans blue.
Ooh.
Really?
Denim, like a nice indigo denim. Yeah. You hate that.
It's not the same blue.
Last time I wore a pair of blue jeans, I went in the ocean. I did literally what it said on the label, and I went in the ocean, swam around, and then rolled around in the sand, and then went back in the ocean to try and get rid of it.
No, I like all sorts of blue. I like cyan blue.
Yeah, he does like blue.
I do. I really do. It doesn't suit me. It doesn't suit me at all. But
I don't understand the cyan thing.
What? So you guys actually discuss colours? Like, that's great.
Normally nowadays it's like, this one's going to be orange. No, it's not.
Yeah.
What is the best advice you've ever received when it comes to art and music that you can impart?
Burn all your work. That was, like I was saying about that thing, I think that was probably my sort of formative thing that will stay with me forever. It's just like, if you burn all your work, it doesn't matter. It's just art.
Mine would be like, you know, stay an amateur, stay with beginner's mind, don't get hung up on being clever, ever.
Yeah,
love that.
You got kicked out of Exeter Art School, but you do credit art education preparing you creatively for later.
No, I didn't.
Work.
No, I actually finished my degree.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I finished. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, we both finished
with roughly the same mark, but he was clearly better at it.
No, well, you know, that was. Tom was giving out A4 computer-aided drawing.
I was on the edge, almost falling off of what would you be considered, like, art, really, at that point.
And mine was massive screen prints of cops beating people up at the poll tax,
right? That's right.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Which was my...
there's a lot of David Wojnarowicz in your work as well. When you're talking about drawing on the maps, he took a lot of, kind of, like, New York subway maps and Manhattan maps and would do screen prints over the top.
Yeah, but more... what's his name?
Rauschenberg.
Rauschenberg, Jasper Johns, and then some Rauschenberg.
More Rauschenberg, probably. I've probably stolen more from Rauschenberg. Hockney.
Yeah, Hockney. When we were in Paris, there was this time we were in Paris at the beginning of Cadet. First thing we did was we went to see Hockney's landscape exhibition, the enormous fucking Grand Canyon.
That
changed our lives completely.
Because he'd made it all out of square canvases. Yeah. They were all square.
Blew our heads.
Loads of them stuck together.
Blew our heads.
What year was this? Early 90s?
Just at the beginning of Cadet and Amnesia.
Yeah,
90,
I guess 98. I don't know.
Wow. Have you met him?
No.
Have you met any famous artists?
No.
I once went to Rauschenberg's place before he died, but he was very ill, and I heard him rumbling around upstairs.
Really?
Didn't get there.
Yeah. I almost felt like you were going to say you were going to write a song called Rauschenberg, because the way you repeated it, it actually sounds really good. Well, thank you so much, both of you. This has been the most amazing privilege to hear about yours.
It's very nice to talk to you about all this stuff. I was really nervous about it.
Between it all. And they are so linked, the visuals and the music and all of it. It's just an amazing
story. Honestly, in my head, it always has been. I think music and art, when music is working, it is visual. It always has been for me.
Yeah, and it makes life a lot easier for me if there's music to draw to.
Yeah, likewise, though, but once we've produced these images, when the images start appearing and we're still working on the music, it's so exciting. It's absolutely the most exciting moment, because there's this link that, you know, it's the same when we do videos and all sorts of things.
That was good with In Rainbows. I think that was the first time we were able to have all of the work we were working on as screensavers on all of the monitors in the whole recording studio. So they'd all be going, you know, when they weren't being used, they were going through this cycle.
That's right.
Everyone in the band could go, oh, I like that one. And we get sort of an idea of
like, crowdsourcing. Oh. Yeah. And you'd refer to like a rough track as a sketch anyway, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, but the way I do music is so... I'm so not doing verse choruses anymore. So that it's like, it's the only way I can describe it, because I can't read music. So the way I work with my laptop is the way I'd work if I was standing in front of a blank canvas. I mean, like, I start making marks. Some of them are going to work, some of them are not. Some of them I'm going to get rid of. I'm going to focus on this. I'm going to loop this bit. It's the same for me. It's the same thing.
Amazing. Thanks, guys.
It's all right.
It's been fantastic.
The exhibition at Christie's is on until the 15th of October, and hopefully we're going to get this out in time for people to actually visit it. And then if you don't get to see the actual physical exhibition, there's obviously a different kind of physical, but it's going to be a digital exhibition. Metaphysical exhibition.
Yes, good
which,
one.
Which is like a expansion of all of these worlds. And it's really exciting from the clips that I've seen earlier through PlayStation, and also it'll be available on Mac and PC, which is very inclusive.
For free.
And also there are two books coming out, one with drawings and writing, and then one with all the paintings and lots of different narratives and stories, as well as the music, which I'm sure everybody listening is already aware of. But Kid A. Amnesiac is the title of the whole kind of project. Thank you so much for listening, everyone. And are you on Instagram?
Yeah,
I know you are actually.
Yes, I am. Yes, so, yes, of course I am. Yeah,
Stanley Donwood.
Yeah, I think yes.
Okay, and you're there as well, but you haven't updated it for a while. I think.
I'm like, yeah,
a bit busy.
Facebook, Instagram. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Fair enough. And you can find images of everything we've talked about at our Instagram at TalkArt. Yeah. Thank you for listening.
Thanks, guys.
We'll be back very soon.
Thank you.
Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.